Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
James Montague. I'm a journalist and author of 1312 Among the Ultras.
James, thank you very much for joining us for this episode of Ramble Meets. Great to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be back in the box.
Yeah, you're a regular visit, a semi-regular visit here, really, aren't you?
Well, three, but I mean, it's not. I like it, you know.
Give you a hat-trick ball then if it's just there. Yeah. You were here to talk about your new book, 1312, Among the Ultras, and we will come onto that, of course, because that's the main reason we're here. But for those who are listening who aren't hugely aware of your work, there can't be many of them out there, but there are a few. Describe to us, if you wouldn't mind, exactly what you do.
I guess I write about kind of obscure football around the world and the culture, politics and... you know, the interesting human stories that come out of that. So, I mean, I don't actually write about kind of football mainly,
yeah,
or much about English football. I never really cover English football, and I've lived abroad for a few years. So I've written a number of books. Some people might have seen my journalism in New York Times or more recently the Bleacher Report, mm-hmm. where I've started making a few films for them. But the thread amongst all of them are just kind of untold underdog stories somehow tangentially connected to football. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's been quite good fun. And so it's kind of led me to this, my fourth book, 1312, Among mm-hmm. the Ultras, and where I've decided I wanted to tell the stories of this kind of very secretive and unknown subculture, which we see almost every day on every football match we watch, every mm-hmm. Champions League match, every Europa League match, every Italian football match, everything. We see ultras are there. You see the pyro, you see the choreographies, everything. And yet it's such a secretive thing that no one really knows anything about it, which also means that they're kind of othered as dangerous hooligans and caricatured in a certain way. And so I wanted to get, you know, deep into the scene and try and tell a bit more of a nuanced story about how they've grown into something which is pretty much one of the biggest youth cultures in the world today.
Yeah, and this is a worldwide tale as well, because clearly you take in the book, you take in countries in South America, Europe, the New World, as you call it, out the Far East, that kind of stuff. Just because I'm personally quite interested, how many countries have you been to covering football in this way?
It was about, I counted it the other day because my publisher asked me to.
Yeah.
And I think it was about 90.
Okay.
But that includes...
Disputed territories
like Western Sahara, Kosovo, West Bank, Palestinian territories, yeah. Transnistria,
yeah,
which is a little sliver of unrecognised independent country that's still a little bit like the Soviet Union, but between Ukraine and Moldova. Mm. So there's a few of those. But yeah, around 90.
Yeah. So you're walking the walk as well as talking the talk as well.
Yeah, I mean,
You've got to be out there.
I mean, I love traveling. I live in the Balkans, and have lived in Eastern Europe for the past few years. And, you know, we were talking about earlier. I mean, I read George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia when I was about 18. And it was a revolutionary moment, really, because you thought, if you're going to do something like this, if you're going to go out and you know, want to be a journalist or a writer or try to tell stories about something that's happening in the world, you've got to be there. And he was there with a gun, you know, shooting at fascists, and he takes a bullet in the neck, which probably more than likely is one of the reasons why he dies at such a young age. And you think, well, I mean, that's a sacrifice for your art. And I mean, I haven't been shot yet, thankfully. No. So I might quit whilst I'm ahead.
I think you'll be safe in here, mate.
Yeah, looks like it, doesn't it? Oh, it looks like one of those magicians' rooms where they put, you know, when they put the woman in, when they stick the swords in.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some swords will come down. Like,
I've got a few swords under the table. It depends how this goes. So you mentioned a second ago that, you know, this idea of ultra culture that we witness, maybe even sometimes we don't even know we're witnessing it when we watch football, either in person or on TV. But what to you then is the difference between a football fan, a passionate football fan, and an ultra?
It's an organisational structure, basically. I mean, ultra means to go beyond in Italian and originally in Latin, and that's where it kind of comes from. And the scene emerges from Italy in the late 1960s, and it's kind of a reflection of the political turmoil that's taking place in Italy at the time. 68 onwards, you know, there's huge protests, far left and far right protests in the town and city squares of Italy. And it presages basically the years of lead, which is a period of Italian history I didn't know much about until I started looking into the ultras, which is, you know, a period of, you know, roughly 15 years where you have far left and far right terrorist groups bombing each other, assassinations, civilians being killed in their hundreds, you know, almost on a daily basis. It's almost like a low-level guerrilla war. And the ultras kind of emerge in the late 60s and kind of take that colour and pageantry of a political protest and take it to the stands. And in this kind of culture, they have flares, pyrotechnics, banners, they send messages, and they have a very hierarchical structure with a capo, kind of leader of the group, who's at the front with a megaphone, or, you know, just with a loud voice, leading the chants and kind of setting the kind of agenda for his group. And often they were extremely political, I mean, reflective of the society that they found themselves in. So at the time, many groups in Italy were very left-wing, because, for instance, in Rome was a very left-wing city. I mean, you had, certainly within the center of the city, the Communist Party was very powerful. So it wasn't unusual to see groups like the Fedayeen, who, you know, are named after a Palestinian kind of liberation terrorist organization from that period. So, you know, obviously later on in the 80s, as Italy becomes, and there's a much more of a foothold for the far right, especially in the big cities, you know, the groups then reflect more far right politics as well. So ultras are this, you know, this incredibly complex, hierarchical, kind of anti-authority, anti-police institution that goes beyond in support of their football team. And 24/7, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you are dedicated to it. And that's why it's a youth movement, because once you get older, you don't have the time to dedicate that much to your team. And so there is also a cycle of renewal. You know, at some point when you're 30, you're almost a pensioner in the ultra scene. And then, you know, you move on, you get a family, and then you have the young blood who come in at 13, 14. And so there's this constant kind of churn of youth and vigour. And so it was a continuously evolving scene. And then what happens really from there, I mean, this is why it's a global book and not a book just about Italy, is that the ultra scene then spreads all around the world, really first to the Balkans and to the kind of South Europe. And then after the fall of communism in Eastern Europe, Russia, Northern Europe and Germany, Scandinavia, North Africa at the beginning of the 21st century, Turkey, Asia, and, you know,
South America as well.
South America is a bit of a different situation, because they also have, you know, in Argentina, you have the Barras Bravas, right? Which is, you know, a lot of people will know about, like Boca Juniors, for instance, who I go and meet their batter, which was La Dosa, which is one of the most kind of infamous and feared kind of fan organisations in the world. And in many respects, they're extremely similar to ultras. And that's not that surprising because they developed in the 1940s, but...
They've developed and evolved independently from the movement you just mentioned there.
It is independent, but it's not independent. Because right. if you look at Boca, the neighbourhood, and in fact, most of Argentina, you know, of course, there's a strong connection with Italy.
Yeah.
And I think in Boca, the neighbourhood, in fact, in Buenos Aires, I think this is 70% of people can trace some kind of lineage back to Italy. Mm. And so you have immigrants coming from Genoa. Boca's nickname is even, you know, a Spanish Argentine version of Genoese. Mm. So, you know, there is this kind of cross-pollination of, you know, it's the same people, the same idea, the same kind of fan culture. Mm. You know, Genoa is a very important port city. Football comes through Genoa into Italy with the British. Mm. And it comes out of Genoa into Argentina, into Boca. So it's no surprise that they're two very, very similar kind of fan cultures develop. And then you've got the Torcida as well in Brazil, which develops. And again, it's a story of globalization. I mean, I start the book in Croatia, which has Europe's oldest fan group, which actually predates 1968 and the start of the first groups in Italy, which is a group called Torcida of Hajduk Split. And that gets formed because Yugoslavia plays at the 1950 World Cup. Mm. And the Yugoslav players go to the Maracanã, play against Brazil, lose in the famous 1950 World Cup where the Maracanazo, where
Brazil lost to Uruguay,
In the final. Yeah. But this game they win, and there's an amazing story about how one of the Torcidas of Flamengo is basically, the guy called Jaime de Carvalho is basically told, like, you can be now not just the band of Flamengo, you can be the band of Brazil. Mm. And so they go and they hear the sound of the Torcida, and they're so impressed by it and they're so intimidated by it that they take it back and they don't even have a recording of it. They explain to a group of students what it's like and they try to recreate it.
Right, okay.
And then get banned for like 35 years. But so it shows that it's not... South America is almost... It's kind of a parallel fan culture to
ultras. But there are links between them.
But links between them. And in a way, what the ultras then become as globalization speeds up, technology improves, television becomes ubiquitous, color television becomes ubiquitous. What we now know as ultras, if we see them today, is actually a kind of mix of all of them and English hooliganism, which is still... aesthetically, at least, a very powerfully influential thing, even though it doesn't really exist.
So it's almost been homogenised now.
Yeah, so it's been... Yeah. I mean, yeah, in a way. And it's... So when you... Like, the reason why I end with Indonesia, which is a fascinating fan culture, is that when you go to a game with the ultras of a team in Indonesia, you notice that they will have the British Railway sign on a flag next to Everyone Hates Us and We Don't Care from Millwall.
Right, so a lot of influence from the kind of old hooligan travelling in the 70s and 80s and stuff.
Exactly, you know, and they'll mix that up with kind of a Brazilian style drum, you know, and the type of kind of organisational structure you might see in Argentina, but they'll still use the language of Italy. So, you know, there's a group from PSS Sleiman, on which is a game I go and see in the southeast of Java Island, and they're called Brigata Curva Sud. You know, so it's all mixed together. You know, after the game they do an Icelandic hand clap,
right?
And so you can see how globalization has kind of taken all of that, and it isn't just mashing it together and imposing a Western or kind of global culture on someone else. I mean, there's already a indigenous fan culture that gets kind of pulled up into it as well, which gives it its own unique flavour. So, yeah, it's kind of everyone's influenced each other. And when you see this spread all around the world and you see it in every league, you realise that when you explain it, you're kind of telling a story of not just football spread, but because that's a well-known story about how football becomes, you know, from Victorian, or how we codified it in Victorian Britain to being the biggest sport in the world.
It's almost a story of globalisation.
Yeah, it is a story of globalisation, but what hasn't been talked about is how the fan culture has done much the same. And it's not necessarily centred in Britain, which is the story we understand about football. The biggest driver for this, because it was the best, most colourful league in the world, was Serie A and Italian ultra culture, which is why the language is so dominant. When everybody's called a tifosi, Tifo is, you know, everybody uses Italian phrases and language.
Mm. And what do you think it travelled then? What do you think it made that sort of journey, as short as a journey as it might be, because I understand Italy, you know, football's very popular in Italy, and I presume it was in the 60s as well. Why did it make that move from a political kind of point into the terraces of a football stadium?
Well, it does. I mean, it retains its political character. Mm. That's the thing. I mean, you notice that the groups, you know, they, although the rivalries aren't necessarily political, because there's a phrase called campanilismo, which means bell towers, effectively in Italian. And Italy is a pretty new country. It was unified in the 19th century, and before that, it was a set collection of warring city states, you know, under occupation by various different empires. I mean, it was a patchwork,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
And so when there is a unified state, I mean, there's that famous phrase from one of its founders, you know, we've made Italy, now we must make Italians.
Mm.
And so, you know, Campanilismo talks about the idea that your allegiance is not necessarily to the state or even to your region, but to your bell tower, because every city and town,
sure,
has a church. And so that's your...
Yeah.
That's where your allegiance lies. And that's why football rivalries in Italy are so fierce, because it's not necessarily left or right or north and south, which is often said, but it's about your bell tower.
Mm.
That's it. So it's,
okay,
it can be even more micro than that. And over the years, I mean, Italy's a really important chapter in this book, and you realise the very political nature of it all. I mean, there's a chapter when I go to Italy and I meet Fabrizio Piccitelli, who's diabolic. Yeah.
The Atalanta capo.
No, this is the leader of the far right, neo-fascist,
okay,
Il Ducibile,
okay,
in of Lazio.
Okay.
And, you know, we go and meet him, and it takes a long time for us to get access to him, to speak to him, because he doesn't really give interviews to Westerners.
How did you go about facilitating that then?
Well, so this is the hardest part of the book was getting access, because as a journalist, this is the thing. I mean, one of the reasons, 1312 means ACAB. It's an alphabet code. It means all cops are bastards, right?
Right.
Okay. It's a number that I saw literally on every stadium, everywhere I went to in the world.
Right.
Jerusalem, Sarajevo, Tokyo, it didn't matter. Every stadium had this number. It's a unifying code of ultras everywhere, which is a hatred of authority, but also a hatred of police. And what I found is the flip side of the same coin was also the hatred of the media, mm-hmm, especially hatred of journalists,
yeah,
which is one reason why they covet their secrecy so much. And it's very difficult to get access to. We are untrustworthy. We are part of the reason why ultra culture is derided. I mean, it creates a kind of circle firing squad as well, firing squad, because even if you, let's say, if you wanted to do a positive story, they wouldn't let you in because they wouldn't trust you. So therefore, the old stories get perpetuated.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was very, very difficult. I mean, this is something, I mean, I've been in the scene, and I've always been attracted to the ultra culture because of some of the best stories are there. And it's also the forbidden fruit as well. Like, you want to be involved and you want to find out more about it because they don't want you to find out about
it. But James, presumably you can't just turn up and start standing with them and start talking to them, particularly if you don't share the language.
No.
So there's a process, right?
No, there is a process. And so what happened was I was trying to utilize as many of my contacts as possible, try to find the best possible people, because it's kind of an honor system, you know, that somebody has to vouch for you.
Mm.
And if you're there and they can vouch, and somebody who they know their face and they've got enough prestige in the scene, and they will say, there's one time I was in the Pollywood Stadium in the North Stand, and a colleague of mine, a friend of mine who, you know, was an ultra and he's not really involved in the scene so much anymore, but still goes to the games, so he's still known. He took me along, and I'm his property.
Right.
I remember taking a picture with my phone, which was in early days of doing the book, which is a no-no. You can't take pictures. You can't film anything.
No.
And a guy grabs me. And if he wasn't there, I mean, I would have been taken to the cleaners.
Yeah.
But he intervened and said, no, he's with me. And he goes, oh, yeah, okay, you know. So there, it's an old, you know, he knows him because of all his old, he's put in years of work.
But you're writing a story, though. Do they know that?
So they don't know that, but
so they know that now, presumably.
Oh, well,
they will do.
They will do. But at that point, I wasn't necessarily writing the chapter. I wanted to experience it first.
Right. Okay.
So actually, I didn't include anything from that trip on that occasion. I went back to Split, like three or four times. I mean, night bus from Belgrade. Right. But the on other occasions, for, Martino, who works for Copper 90, Martino Ressi, who you everybody should follow, who's a fantastic journalist, does a lot of great stuff. A very energetic presence on Copper 90.
Right.
He has developed incredible contacts within the Italian fan scene as well. And then, you know, managed to navigate the incredibly, polarized politics as well. So with him, he helped me out loads getting, trying to get access to people. And because people are used to a very sensationalist way of covering it, what we wanted to let them know was that this wasn't an expose.
No.
I wanted to find out what's the history? How did it happen? Even when I sat down with Diabolik in the Lazio Il Duce Blu clubhouse next to a portrait of Mussolini.
Right.
And his underlings, when he gets out of the car, I remember they all gave...
Really?
They all gave the...
they all gave a Nazi salute.
They all gave the Roman salute, which Roman is where Nazi salute comes from. They all gave it. I mean, he was, he's assassinated 3 months later, so he can't talk for himself anymore. But he would have... I mean, he openly called himself a fascist. He was proud to call himself a fascist. So me saying that probably isn't too big a deal. But when he was quite surprised, because when we sat down, the first thing he did was roll a joint
right, and
hand it to me, which was, are you going to be in this scene or you're not going to be in this scene? So we did, we partook, the first thing he said, so I guess you want to know about the violence.
Yeah.
Because that's what the questions he's always asked about the greatest hits, all the fights of the 80s and 90s, what was your greatest fight and all this. And in a way, I did want to hear about that. I wanted to hear what his views were on violence, but I asked him different questions that he'd been asked before. And that's why we ended up having a 2-hour interview where it was a brilliant interview where he told us about his kind of worldview. I mean, quite frightening worldview, but also how the Il Duce Blu came to life and what it meant to him and the people around him. And
what do you think gets someone like that up in the morning? What do you think? What is it all based around? His own sort of personal, as twisted as you or I might find it, his own personal pride about where he's from and his heritage. Is that what gets him up in the morning? Why is he doing it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's about, I mean, he's from Rome. He knew he was of the far right from a young age. Mm. He grew up in an area where there was it was mainly far left Romas from Fedayeen, ultras from Fedayeen, and he kicked against that. And as he said, at 14, 15, he was a bastard, and he had a collection of friends who were also bastards, and they just wanted to come together as a gang, and they found identity and belonging in it, and that became what he then took over was the Il Duce Blu and took that onto a much wider, it's a sense of belonging and sense of community. And he didn't even think that, I asked everybody where I went, how do you describe ultras? And actually it was amazing that everybody gave a different answer. Like, and a lot of people struggled to give an answer to what an ultra was. And his answer was, I don't see the Il Duce Blu as ultras. I put them above ultras.
Right.
It was for him a gang, and the
footballs are almost irrelevant to it.
Football's almost irrelevant to it because he was also someone, he openly told me he didn't know, he couldn't tell you who his favourite Lazio players were at that moment. He just spent 2 years in prison on drug trafficking charges. So I guess he probably didn't watch a lot of football in the past 2 years. But it was also fascinating that he didn't, and I found that quite a lot, like the leader of one of the biggest firms in Ukraine for Dynamo Kiev, he wasn't that interested in the football. There's a lot, it could have been a gang of graffiti artists or Hell's Angels or handball players or whatever it is. But it was about a small community of people who wanted to have a sense of belonging and trust. And that's why trust is absolutely at the bedrock of everything.
This is almost the way you're describing this. It's interesting you say it, because I've suspected for a while now that, and I'm talking about particularly, English football hooligans, the football feels to me like a bit of an afterthought. They don't really mind if they watch a game or not. And what you're saying there is completely solidifying that opinion. What you're describing to me feels a bit like organised crime rather than football.
I'll tell you, on one side, yes. I mean, there are people who aren't that interested in it. It's about the community, so it's not necessarily whether it's organised crime or whatever. It's about having a group of people where that bond is completely unbreakable.
Mm.
And that's a very powerful thing for all humans to want. And they've just found a way of getting that through football. At the same time, you know, most of the ultras I spoke to outside of the handful of leaders that I spoke to, you know, it was a football thing. That's the basis of what it is. I mean, every subculture you go to, I mean, I mentioned graffiti, biking, whatever, you know, at punk rock, you know, at its root is a band playing. At its root is spray painting something on a wall. It's an art project.
So there's a prime mover, basically.
So there's a motive there.
Yeah.
And then when you see then what, you know, the subculture that is around it, of course, it becomes something vast and huge and very far removed in some respects from the origins. But there was an absolute love, like the rank and file who are standing there in the curve. You know, it is about football and an obsession with football. An obsession, I mean, maybe not necessarily even the game, because, I mean, a lot of people turn their back to the football.
Yeah.
The capo doesn't see the game, you know. And when I asked one guy, a leading ultra from Roma, about this, he said, you know, Roma to my back, Rome to my front.
Mm.
And to him, it was all about giving his team the advantage over the opposition. And if that meant him not watching the game, then that's what he would do.
Mm.
So, but then... You mentioned organized crime, and there is, you know, a huge streak crossover with organized crime and football fan culture, especially in ultras. And this is something I spoke to Il Boccia, the leader of the Atalanta ultras, who we'll talk about in a minute, I'm sure. But you know, he was like, you know, every curve, especially in the north of Italy, has been taken over by organized crime, and we can see there's been a string of police raids recently on ultras groups from Juventus and beyond, where, you know, they will find, I mean, they even found a bloody air-to-air missile from the Qatari Air Force, one of them had bought, alongside loads of kind of literature, Nazi literature, all this kind of stuff, and it connected to Camorra, as well as kind of far-right militias. I mean, it's you know, it does happen. And especially in South America, when you see the Ballas Bravas, you know, there's no doubt that there's a strong, enduring connection to organised crime. And I think one of the reasons that is that if you live outside the law, or purport to live outside the law, and that's what, like, this 1312, you know, ACAB, you know, it's a short journey to then saying, well, do you know what else is outside of the law? You know, being outside the law, like, properly. So you can see how that ethos of, like, being against authority, against the state, against, you know, in some ways society itself, and creating your own society, how that, you know, you could see organized crime as being more your flavor than the police or authority. So it's not that surprising to see that crossover.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
This is a really immersive book as well. This is not a book that's been written, it seems to me, by making a couple of phone calls and digging up a couple of books from the library. I mean, you've immersed yourself within
it. I did that as well.
Yeah, I'm sure you did. No, I'm not suggesting it's not meticulously researched. I'm just saying that you it's almost a gonzo book. You're in there doing it. And the one particular chapter that really sticks in my mind that read that subject is when you're in Sweden with the Hammarby fans who have teamed up with Brøndby fans from Denmark and looking to go and have a good old-fashioned dust-up with a bunch of Eichel fans. And you're, I mean, really, you're running, I mean, I don't want to give too much away because I think people should read the book, but you're running with them. You're a part of this at this point, James, and I wonder how that felt for you.
It was, there was a big, all the way through the book, there was a big moral issue that I had.
Yeah.
Because in many cases, because it's a scene of extremes. You know, I think I'd even write this line. There aren't centrist ultras. You know, you have most ultras I meet, especially in Eastern Europe, the Balkans and beyond, are, you know, ultra-nationalist, on the far right, connection to neo-Nazis, connection to neo-fascists. Mm. And so that's not the entire scene. I mean, if you go to Germany, if you go to Sweden, and Sweden's quite apolitical, but if you go to Germany, you know, you see groups, as many left-wing groups as right-wing groups, and sure, we've seen in the past couple of weeks, you know, their story has come to the fore as they're campaigning to preserve 50+1.
Yeah.
A lot of people are against racism, a lot of groups against sexism.
But Fortuna Düsseldorf would be quite an example of quite a left-wing
country. Yeah, Werder Bremen.
Freiburg as well.
Freiburg, I go to Freiburg, yeah. You know, with one of their groups, because their group, you know, along with a group from Hanover, really saved 50+1. It was really in danger a couple of years ago. And they
successfully fought against their Monday Night Football and that kind
exactly.
of stuff.
Exactly.
Well,
so, yeah. you've got that as well. But, you know, at the same time, there are people that I was speaking to and interviewing who, you know, had you know, extremist views, which, you know, then, for want of a better phrase, I mean, they're on the Nazi spectrum. You know, there's one guy I remember interviewing who's, you know, very quiet, friendly guy, you know, and he's got four swastikas on his head. And later on, I found out he's got swastikas tattooed on his feet as well. You know, and so when you hear these views, and we had this with Diabolik as well, when he was telling us his worldview, and I'm like, at what point do I... What point retelling this story? Am I promoting
endorsing
his agenda,
it, yeah,
or endorsing,
yeah,
it?
Yeah. And did you challenge any of them at any point?
Yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, you ask, you know, you are challenging them. But I think that if there was a camera crew there, you know, I think I might get a lot of criticism for not, you know, walking out or not, you know, being kind of aggressively taken into task over it. But at the same time, that technique I don't think would have worked in that scenario for safety reasons. But also, you know, the technique that I always looked at, and I think that they have had very similar criticism as well, is when you, like, if Homish Catalonia was one book that I read that was very influential. Another one was Them by John Ronson.
Yeah.
Which I've read, just fantastic. Wonderful book.
So he starts running with Alex Jones. And
And I know he's written a kind of mea culpa since, because Alex Jones then becomes this kind of monstrous figure.
They try and break into Bilderberg at some point.
And he's like, oh my God, maybe they've got a point here.
Yeah.
You know, maybe Alex Jones has a point here. Yeah. And it's also with Louis Theroux as well, which is, if you want to ask these, you do ask searching questions, but you've also got to be proximate, you've got to be close, and you've got to also bring out the fact that a lot of the people who are saying monstrous things aren't necessarily monsters, or, you know, they love their families, they have kids, you know, 90% of their life is completely normal. And then they have this part of their life, which is absolutely abhorrent what they believe in. Mm. And so I took that kind of attitude to it, but it was a constant moral re-evaluation about what I was doing and the type of questions I was asking and the kind of way I would write it afterwards. And but then the other issue as well was when I witnessed kind of acts of violence. And Sweden, that you brought up, was one such thing. I mean, a subculture of the subculture of ultras, which I think is going to be something that is only going to get bigger and people are going to hear more about, is this arranged fighting scene.
Yeah, this is what I've alluded to there.
Yeah, right? So it's called, I mean, it's massive in Eastern Europe. In Russia and Ukraine, it's called Okola Footballer, like around football it means. Mm. And Poland, it's called Ustawka. And it's, you know, it's essentially a kind of type of martial art, like combat sport, and you have violence doesn't take place at the stadiums anymore. You go to these secretive, highly illegal, highly violent fights, which are arranged through encrypted apps like Telegram. Mm. And you go and you know, you can't find the videos of these fights anywhere. It's really underground, and you know, to get access to it is very, very difficult. But then, you know, they've got rules. You'll play 10 against 10. 15 against 15, 100 against 100. And when they fight, I mean, people train in, you know, combat martial arts.
Is this what MMA. We saw in from the Russian fans in Marseille?
The reason why they were like that is because they have been groomed and trained in Okola Footballer. A lot of the guys you meet don't drink.
Right.
They're straight edge.
So they treat themselves as athletes, basically.
So they treat themselves, I mean, and there's a lot of steroid use as well. Mm. So, but I mean, there's not drug testing yet in the scenes.
No, not really.
But yeah, so they really take it seriously, and it's a dedicated lifestyle. And so then, you know, what happens is you get these fights taking place, and they're extremely violent. And when I went to Sweden, I actually got access to one of these. Mm. And it was, I thought, okay, so all the time you're calculating what is the risk in this situation. Mm. And the guy who runs the kind of firm for Hammarby was, you know, very friendly guy, very interesting, very intelligent guy as well. And, it, he's very upfront about it, which was, you know, this is about, of course, it's a culture that I love. Mm-hmm. I love the firm. I love the connection to the football club, mm. which isn't always the case. I met people who knew about firms in Ukraine, who are part of firms for football clubs that don't exist anymore. The only thing that exists of football clubs gone out of business, but the firm still exists.
Right.
And, and it was for him, it was an adrenaline thing. You know, mm. it was purely the rush of the fight. And I thought, well, once I knew that I was allowed to go in, which is an extremely rare thing to do.
Why did they grant you particularly?
Because I think we did an interview and we sat down and talked about it for a long while, and I recognized why he did it. I mean, I wasn't a hooligan. I wasn't involved in football hooliganism as a kid, but I got in quite a lot of trouble with the police. You know, I was arrested numerous times. But it was, for me, the chase from the police was the most, like, that was the drug. Mm. And like, so when he talked about that, we kind of talked about this. You know, okay, I can recognize that. I can understand that.
Yeah,
and I think because of that, he was like, okay, you can come along. I mean, Mikkel, who was kind of my guide in the Swedish scene and also in South America, who great Swedish guy, you know, who's in his 50s now, but he's like a godfather of the ultra scene in Sweden and had really good connections in South America, and we traveled around everywhere together. I mean, he even warned me not even to ask to go and watch the fight. That's how off limits it is.
Right.
But I did, and he said, yeah, you know, come along, and he let me come along, and I thought, okay, like, this isn't like disorganized English hooliganism, which is, you know, it was just you turn up, there's a fight, it could be anywhere, it could be in an urban environment. There were rules. Mm. And there was a certain part of me was like, well, if they're going somewhere where they're fighting amongst each other and it's away from civilians, then, you know, okay. I mean, it's illegal, but ultimately...
Were you not fearful of being mistaken for one of them, though?
Well, this is the thing. Because it's a very, very, very controlled scene... if you're there and you're not fighting, there's no way that you're going to be, because there's a kind of honor network here.
Yeah.
So if there's 10 versus 10, and they're losing, you can't bring in two people to jump in.
Right. Okay.
Because then you're persona non grata and you're kicked out.
Right. Okay.
And you will never fight in the scene again. You're blacklisted. Mm-hmm. All of this is done through social media and through word of mouth. Mm. So, you know, there's, even after they've beaten the hell out of each other, there's an honor afterwards. People will shake hands. They, you know, they sometimes even go for a drink with each other's afterwards, or not drink, but you know, have a joint, whatever.
Bottle of mineral water.
Bottle of mineral water. Yeah. I mean, some of the guys I met, some of them did do cocaine, some of them did do weed, but alcohol was the no-no, because that's what really affects, that's what puts weight on. So
right, okay.
I guess cocaine doesn't put that much, hasn't got that much calories. But it was, I thought it was a controllable environment, because if you're there as an observer, and a rare observer, then there's no way that the violence could be mistaken or be in there, because there are certain norms within that culture that protect you. But unfortunately, I mean, I think it was a 60 versus 60 fight and the other side didn't turn up. And that's when it turned into something else. And again, I had to consider when they said, right, okay, well, we're going to find them in their pub.
Because they've dishonoured this whole arrangement. So they're now going to be punished for that, essentially.
Exactly. And so, and this had never happened before. So
as a journalist, you're presumably quite happy about this, because this is a story, right?
Well, I mean, I'm disappointed in the one way, because I thought I would finally get to see what this kind of fight looked like. But then they said, okay, we're going to go and find them. And I was actually with somebody who, you know, somebody connected to Hamby, and he was like, right, you know, this is where I get out. This is, you know, I can't get involved in this. And I had to make a decision. It was literally a door of the van of the guy that was going to take me along, and the guy leaving. And it's like, what do I do? Do I go? Do I say that I don't want to see this? Or do I go and see how it shakes down? And so I go. I get in the van. And then we go along, and then, you know, there's got to be 30, 40 of these guys now, maybe more. And they get to this Solna, this area of North Stockholm. North Stockholm. And we get out, and I remember him saying at the back, you know, stay at the back, you know, you can film it if you want. I was like, okay, so I do. And I film it, and I'm chasing, and I'm trying to run after them. I might not look it. I run quite a lot, so I mean, I could keep up with them, but these guys moving fast, I couldn't really keep up with them, and they were a good 10 meters ahead, and then, you know, they ran, you know, and attacked this kind of pub in this district, and, you know, from somewhere where, you know, you thought you were going to be observing something in a controlled environment, to then seeing something that is completely uncontrolled, and now you are part of it. This is out in the wild. You are now part of this. What do you do? Do you now pull the ripcord? Do you now get out? And there was one moment where I'm running, and I run past them, and then I'm scared, because I'm, what if the other group then attacks us and they think I'm part of them? Am I safer to just say, no, I'm not part of them? Or am I safer sticking with them? Because otherwise maybe I'd be beaten up. Maybe I'd be stabbed. Who knows? So I made the decision to keep running with them. And I remember running past this one guy who was kind of unconscious on the floor. I mean, there's blood everywhere. And there's one of his guys holding him up, and just looked at me with absolute hatred. And it was like, it was a really difficult moment, because you could tell that he thought I was them. And, you know, I mean, I guess to him I was. And that carried on. We went to another bar, and they I was following them, and then they smashed up another bar, and that's when the police arrived, and we had to run away, and I managed to escape, because I'm like, if the police catch me in this scenario, I'm, you know,
you're banged to rights, basically.
Yeah, I mean, you know, or I mean, I didn't do anything violent, I could prove it, but you know, there'd be some very, very, very difficult questions about who I was with and why I was there and what I was doing. And you know, once I got my press card out, you know, it would have been very difficult, and I managed to, you know, get out of the situation. But when I was writing that down, I had to sit down. It was the most difficult part of the whole book, because I could have not put it in. And I could not, I could have thought about not writing my culpability or my thoughts in that moment. But I thought that was disingenuous. I mean, this did happen. I was there. I did have to make a kind of moral judgment. And for good or ill, I decided to describe that process, thought process, and what happened, because ultimately that did happen, and that does happen. And I think that is an important element of the scene that needs to be reflected. And I thought there's no way I could live with myself if I didn't write it and I wasn't honest with both myself and the readers.
And in the front of the book, you say that, you know, you're not ascribing a value judgment to any of this stuff. You're saying that you want the readers to make their own decisions about what they read. So I wonder whether you are, in light of that and in light of what you've just described there, whether there was a fear on your part of almost like an inadvertent glamorization of what's happened.
I mean, yeah, I mean, there was, of course. And when I was writing this, I was, you know, you're always thinking about that. And I didn't want that to be the case. And I think I make it quite clear that these aren't views I agree with or necessarily, you know, the violence isn't something I agree with. But also, if I'm honest, I mean, I've got to say that I can understand the motivation for it, because that's the whole point of this. Why do people do this? I mean, it is a thrill. It's a drug. It's a drug. And, you know, there's a moment at the end of the Sweden chapter where, you know, I've got back to my hotel and I've escaped, and, you know, there's almost a feeling of elation. And
adrenaline, basically.
Yeah. And I thought I my publisher wanted me to take it out. And I was like, no, I want to keep it in, because I think that is, I wanted readers to understand that that is why people do
this. The seduction of it, basically.
It's the seduction of violence. And that's, you know, that is what makes this go round. That's what makes this subculture of the subculture go round. And not just that, I think violence in general, whether it's organized combat sport to, you know, Friday night punch up outside of a pub, you know, it's domination and it's adrenaline. And I think that by describing that, I think that that, well, by not describing it, I think that would have been, I think that not describing that would have been a dereliction of duty, I think.
And how much does violence play in the ultras scene in general? Does it vary from place to place?
I mean, so this is another question I was always summing up all the way through, is that, I mean, ultras will tell you, or groups around the world, you know, you just want a journalist, that is. I mean, not me personally, although I would be considered part of this beast that is journalism by them. Regardless of what you're all the same, basically.
Yeah.
And that all they're interested in is, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. You know, when there's fights, when there's violence, all you're interested in is the violence. But at the same time, and you know, the ultra scene is just full of moral contradictions, full of it, you know. Yes, they're annoyed that we concentrate on the violence, or that my colleagues might concentrate on the violence. But at the same time, you know, it is a really big part of a large part of the scene. I mean, maybe not as extreme as the kind of arranged fighting scene, which is kind of right on the edge of what ultra culture is. But even, you know, I mean, on almost a comic level, I mean, people are stealing each other's banners.
Yeah.
And that leads to conflict, and that leads to fighting. And, you know, a lot of groups also get their reputations from the way the media have kind of reported on that violence. And they're kind of quite proud of how that kind of comes out. So on the one hand, they are, you know, against how we, or how journalists kind of portray it. But on the other hand, you know, there's no doubt that it has been a quite important part of the scene, and quite, you know, integral part of the scene in many respects. So it can be quite a dangerous world. And it's also a world that, you know, there's one journalist in particular, Pierluigi Spagnolo, who wrote a great book in Italy about ultras. And, you know, he told me, you know, it is a scene that's learned how to protect itself. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, it's not afraid to have a fight, because if it doesn't fight back, it would be crushed. And I think there is some truth in that as well.
And I wonder, one of the questions that kind of sprung to mind upon reading the book is, I wonder if the prevalence of this is happening as a reaction to football, the modernisation of football and it being perceived to have been taken away from its roots, in quotes, by TV companies, by commercialisation and all the rest of it. Is that seen, in your opinion, an increase in this activity, or is it always just always been there?
I mean, in a certain respect, it's always been there. If you speak to, there's a chapter in Germany, and there's a couple of interviews there where, you know, as long as football has existed in Germany, there's been violence.
Right.
It's just the type of violence and the organisation of the violence. Mm. So for a long time, you know, German football in particular, you know, they had a very English style hooliganism, which is kind of nihilistic, but also, I mean, probably contradictory to saying it's nihilistic, but also connected a lot to the far right, you know. But it was, you know, this disorganized urban violence, basically. Mm. And then ultra scene arrives in the 1990s with the arrival of Eurosport, basically, and free to air Serie A. And people start copying that, which starts changing the scene to be a bit more colourful, a bit more, bit less violent. But then the influence of the organised fighting scene, which kind of, it does, I mean, Germany is part of that, but it gets popularised in Eastern Europe. It changes the nature of the violence later on into this much more, into the scene that we see today. So I'm not sure if it's more, but it's certainly changed from being disorganized to being much more organized. But saying that, one of the kind of the moral fuel at the center of ultras everywhere is this anti-commercialization, anti-modern football, anti-moderno calcio. You know, this is the idea that there was this bygone age of football that is being taken away by money, by TV, by technology, by capitalism. And, you know, that's why you find a lot of groups, even though they have divergent views, they share a thread, not just the hatred of the police, the 1312, but also this idea that this bygone age needs to be preserved. And that's why in Germany in particular, you have a lot of groups that have very different opinions. For instance, we'll join forces and share a view on 50 plus one on Monday Night Football.
Dietmar Hopp.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, you can see what's interesting with the Dietmar Hopp case, the owner of Hoffenheim, is that he's a hated figure, not quite as much as RB Leipzig. Mm. RB Leipzig is the one where, you know, and there's a great story about Dynamo Dresden fans throwing a severed bull's head onto the pitch when they played Leipzig in the cup. Mm. And they got a big fine for that. But Leipzig are really the kind of the king rat of German football. But Hopp is almost as bad. And there's been a kind of campaign against him. And the way that story was kind of played out in the British media in particular was that, like, this was just like abuse towards an owner of a club because of club rivalry. Whereas actually, if you think about what they were actually arguing about, yeah, there was abuse. I mean, calling him a son of a bitch and son of a whore. Mm. You know, there was that tifo of him, you know, dressed as, like, it was supposed to be his mum, but it was him, like, dressed in a dress, and it's distasteful. Mm. But if we look at the issue at its core, what people are arguing against is him being able to circumvent the 50 plus one rule because they believe in this economic model of ownership in German football preserves to some extent what they think football should be, which is a game for the fans in the stadium. Mm. And that is a very complex view to take. It's not an unthinking, abusive, you know, hooligan act. Mm. Like, that's a complicated issue to get thousands of people to agree on, and they do, and they articulate it sometimes in a very forefront, you know, in a very aggressive
problematic way.
Yeah. But ultimately, there's nothing comparable in English football. There's nothing comparable in a lot of places, and I think you know, the Dietmar Hopp thing encapsulates in many ways the good parts and the bad parts of the ultra scene.
And I wonder if you fear any ramifications for some of the stuff you've written in this book, particularly alongside the idea of that the Swedish organised fighting we talked about. You go to a lot of different countries around the world, speak to a lot of difficult characters. Do you fear, is that something you're fearful of?
It crossed my mind, but I hope ultimately it's telling the story it's not untruthful.
But you're trying to be as trying to strike a neutral tone. Is that what you're saying?
Not really. I do take a moral, you know, tone on some of the things that I see. I mean, it's very clear after we interview Diabolik, for instance, that, you know, coming out of that interview, you know, I examine how quickly the things that he says, which I find abhorrent, are kind of normalised in that conversation. So I do take a stance. It's not complete neutrality. But, you know, ultimately, it's not, I haven't gone in there and sensationalized it. I haven't gone in there and lied about anything. You know, this is the truth. This is the truth as I saw it. And I've done that with honesty.
Would you be comfortable going back to all these places?
Yeah, I think so. I think, Yeah, it would be. I mean, in some cases, I mean, it's not possible. Egypt, for instance, I spent a lot of time in Egypt. I mean, I write more in When Friday Comes about the Egyptian ultras, especially the ultras of Cairo. But the leader of the Al Ahly ultras, the Akhlawi, which is now, I mean, now it's a terrorist, they're considered, well, not considered a terrorist organization, but they've been outlawed. All ultras have been outlawed in Egypt.
Just after the Port Said.
And then, you know, there was the Mohamed Morsi, the first democratically elected president, was removed from power and Sisi is now in power. And, you know, straight away, you know, they were outlawed because they were fearful of the revolutionary power that Egyptian ultras had.
Sure.
And I had to make a decision not to go back because I was worried that I would endanger people by going back because it's such a poisonous environment now for activists. People just go to jail. There are hundreds of ultras in jail. Once they were heroes of the revolution, now, you know, they're literally dying in jails. And the leader of the Akhlawi, a good friend of mine, recently died of cancer, and which is a very sad story. But so it's not something that you can really go back to. And there was also, you know, with Diabolik, I mean, we did the interview, and then 3 months later, I got a message, and he'd been shot dead in a park in Rome. You know, he'd been executed, but nothing to do with the Ilha do Chibli, but, you know, he had. There's all sorts of connections to organised crime, and that's more than likely what was the end, what brought the end about. But although no one's really sure, and then the Ilha do Chibli disbanded afterwards. Although they say it's nothing to do with that, you know, it's very clear that, you know, Fabrizio was an absolute core, important glue that kept that group together. So yeah, I would go back. I mean, I was planning on going back to Sweden because the start of the football season, but with the coronavirus, I think that's not going to be possible for now. But yeah, I think I would go back to most places. I think, you know, and if people are unhappy with it, then I'm just going to have to deal with that.
And earlier in the interview, you said you asked lots of different groups of ultras to how they would describe themselves, and you said a lot of people would be at pains to try, kind of do it. You're clearly, you know, the expert in this now. So how do you describe ultra culture?
I'm not sure if this is probably quite controversial, but I think that it's not what something is for. You can't describe. I think that it's so multifaceted that I think it's what people are against, and I think it's an anti. It's an being an ultra is it being against authority? It's an anti-authority urge that people find in football, and whether that's the authority of a football club owner or the police or the security guards in front of you, it's something that you do not want to be controlled, and you want to find a space where you find some kind of freedom or kick out against the restrictions that you see in front of yourselves. And to me, that's what ultras are. But you can define them more about what they're against than what they're for. But it is ultimately a community. And that's why if you think about young people today and technology and the idea that everything can be done online, that young people don't like picking up the phone even. Yet here you have, you know, a physical culture that you have to be part of. You have to be there, you have to be in contact with people, that kind of shuns that technology, that shuns that modern world. You know, that's I can see how that is a really seductive thing for young people to be involved in, because it's become rarer and rarer and rarer. I mean, before the internet, I mean, I can remember a world before the internet, there was all sorts of subcultural things you could be involved in, you know, heavy metal, punk, like whatever, like music. That's all kind of gone in a way, because everything's accessible. Everybody can get that punk record now. You don't have to go to a certain shop in London to buy it. You don't have to put much effort into it. Ultras, you do. Ultras, you've got to live it 24/7. You've got to go beyond still. And so it's a culture. It's a culture of freedom and being against authority. And I think it just happens to be football, and it's not going away anytime soon, I don't think.
James, it's a fascinating story. Thank you very much for sharing it with us.
Welcome. Thanks for having me on.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.